Okay, let's dive into something, well, pretty intense today.
Yeah, this source is definitely making a strong case.
We've got this essay, The War of the Doctrine of Truth, Is YHVH God, or Is Zeir Anpin God, by Shavit David Ben-Shoshan.
That title alone tells you a lot, doesn't it? It sets up this idea of a fundamental conflict.
A real battleground within religious belief. The author sees it as absolutely critical.
Absolutely. And they're framing it as a war. They use foundational texts, Torah, Talmud, figures like Maimonides, the Rambam.
Right. Leaning heavily on those authorities.
But using them to launch a really pointed critique, specifically against mystical traditions, and particularly the Zohar.
Yeah, that's where it gets really specific. They're not just saying it's a different interpretation.
No, they're calling it dangerous, a deviation. They use terms like idolatry, heresy, very strong language.
So our plan here is to really walk through the author's logic, look at the sources they cite.
Exactly. Understand why they see this as such a critical issue for, well, for the religious world today.
And just to be clear, we're sticking strictly to the arguments in this text.
Right. So the core of this war, as the author puts it.
It boils down to this. Never, ever acknowledge other gods.
And they define that really broadly. It means not believing in any power other than God, blessed be he, any power at all.
It's such a high standard. It's not about actions initially.
No, it's about belief. The author insists that just believing in heretical ideas or in the power of something other than God, even if you don't act on it.
Just the belief.
That belief itself is considered a complete denial of the entire Torah.
Think about that. Your thoughts alone could put you outside the pale, according to this view.
It's intense. They cite Exodus 34, you know, the verses about destroying altars, not making covenants with other gods.
And Deuteronomy 13, the warning about prophets leading people astray to serve other gods.
And the consequence. Those figures should be put to death.
The author reads these as a mandate, really, a command to actively fight idolatry.
To root it out completely, anything that leads towards it.
And then they bring in the Rambam, Maimonides, to amplify this.
Oh, absolutely. According to the author, Rambam's view was incredibly strict.
How so?
Well, they say Rambam taught that if you merely doubt a foundational principle, just have a doubt.
You haven't even rejected it, just doubted it.
Right. That doubt means you've left the community. You're a heretic, an epikoros, a cutter of plantings. Those are serious terms.
Wow. And the author says Rambam believed you had to actively oppose such person.
Even destroy them, quoting that verse from Psalms. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? It shows the perceived severity. Any deviation is seen as hating God.
So, okay, practically speaking, what does this mean day to day, according to the author?
Well, back to the main point. Never acknowledge other gods. Don't even say words that suggest it, even if you're scared.
And they give that example, right? About witchcraft.
Yes, it's really striking. If someone fears witches, believes that stuff has any power, even a tiny bit.
Just the fear, the belief in its potential power.
The author says that person, through that belief, has denied the entire Torah.
And they make it very concrete. Going to someone to have a spell removed. That action stems from belief, so it's denying the Torah.
They connect this directly to Rambam's Laws of Idolatry, chapter 11. Rambam apparently wrote that witchcraft is just lies, falsehoods used to trick people.
And that it's not fitting for wise people, for Israel, to get caught up in that kind of vanity.
Exactly. Rambam supposedly compared believing in it, even while knowing it's forbidden, to being ignorant, like, well, like women and children in that context, lacking sense.
Whereas wise people know it's empty.
Right. Pursuing it pulls you from truth, which ties back to that command, be wholehearted with the Lord your God.
Okay, so this sets up a really strict framework. How do they then apply this to actual religious texts? That seems like the really controversial part.
It is. They use the Rambam, again, Laws of Idolatry, chapter 2. Rambam apparently wrote that idolaters wrote many books about their practices.
And God commanded us not to read them.
Not to read them, not to think about them, not even look at related images. Total avoidance.
Citing verses like, do not turn to idols from Leviticus.
And do not inquire about their gods from Deuteronomy.
Even asking how they worship is forbidden.
According to the Rambam cited here, yes. Because even asking could lead you down that path.
So here's the jump the author makes.
This is the crucial step. The author says, based on these words of the Rambam,
therefore,
it's forbidden to read what they call the magical book of the Zohar. Forbidden to even think about its words.
Wow. So they're placing the Zohar directly into the category of forbidden potentially idolatrous texts based on their reading of Rambam.
Exactly. And they doubled down, quoting Rambam again, that all these rules are about not turning towards idolatry in your mind.
Back to the battlefield of thought. Any idea that could undermine a core Torah principle is off limits.
Because, as Rambam is quoted, our understanding is limited. Following every thought would lead to chaos.
And they emphasize Rambam's view.
Mm-hmm.
The ban on idolatry is equal to all other commandments combined.
Which leads to their main point about the Zohar. Anyone who affirms idolatry.
Which they define as.
As anyone who affirms the contaminated book of the Zohar, anyone who believes it has holiness.
That person, they argue, is denying the entire Torah, prophets, everything.
And the reverse. Denying idolatry, specifically denying the Zohar, means you affirm the whole Torah. It's the foundation.
They even quote Rambam saying affirming idolatry even without practicing it is blasphemy.
And that idolaters and blasphemers get the same severe punishment because they both deny the core principle.
Okay, so this builds a very stark picture.
Yeah.
How do they connect this to the present day?
They argue we're living in a time where, quote, the foundations of the religion of truth are in danger and descending into the abyss.
They see now as the time of this war of the doctrine of truth against falsehood.
A falsehood, they claim, is destroying the religion, putting out its light by sneaking idolatry and heresy into our religion, our Torah, and our faith.
And the prime suspect is the Zohar. They then focus on its origins.
Right, the birth of the book of the Zohar. They say it appeared in the 13th century via Moshe de Leon.
In pieces, later compiled. And they call it the contaminated Zohar.
Explicitly. And they insist the traditional author, Rabbi Shon Bar Yochai, Rashbi, never said the things in it. They call it nonsense, written with lies and malice, attributing it to De Leon instead.
How do they argue Rashbi couldn't have written it?
They quote Rashbi from the Talmud, condemning anyone who associates God's name with something else, basically. Idolatry.
So the Zohar's content, in their view, contradicts Rashbi's known principles.
Exactly. They also question Rashbi's expertise in deep mysticism, citing a Jerusalem Talmud passage suggesting another sage was more proficient.
And they bring out the general principle from the Talmud. Teachings need a clear chain of transmission.
Implying the Zohar lacks that clear lineage, that authenticity.
They don't stop there, right? They bring in other historical figures who question mystical texts.
Yeah, to show there's a precedent for skepticism, they quote Rabbeinu Saadia Gaon, a major early figure.
What did he say?
About the book Shir Koma, which describes God physically. Saadia Gaon apparently said it has no tradition, might be fake, and destroying it is a mitzvah, because describing God physically is other gods.
Strong words. And the Rambam, too.
Yes, his responsa allegedly called Shir Koma the work of European preachers, not true sages. And again, Rambam supposedly said destroying it is a mitzvah because physical descriptions of God are other gods.
So they're building a case, questioning mystical texts, especially those giving God physical attributes, has a strong historical basis.
Exactly. Then back to the Zohar. They quote the Novot Ahuda, Rabbi Yitzchak Salandow, from the 18th century.
What was the point?
That even Zohar supporters have to admit it wasn't passed down generation to generation like the Mishnah and Talmud. There's a gap.
So concerns about its transmission and potential for errors or additions over the centuries.
Right, since it appeared long after Rashbi and isn't clearly signed by him.
They also quote Moshe Hagiz.
Another figure from that era. He apparently said it's folly to think Rashbi ordered the Zohar as we have it, comparing it to thinking Abraham had the ordered Talmud. It highlights the absurdity in his view.
Even the Ben Ishai is mentioned, a major Kabbalistic authority himself.
Yes, quoting him saying that the Arezal, the father of Lurianic Kabbalah, acknowledged some parts of the Zohar were later additions by copyists, citing Rabbi Yaakov Emden's critical work.
So after lining up all these historical questions and critiques,
the author delivers their verdict. All these figures, even those who ultimately accepted the Zohar despite questions, they erred.
And they bolster this with a general warning from Rambam's letter to Montpelier.
A very powerful quote. Rambam warns against just believing things because they're written down, especially if the books are old or widely studied.
He said that leads people, fools basically, to think it's great wisdom causing them to go wrong.
The author calls this the great sickness, believing things just because they're in ancient popular books.
And the punchline from Rambam, as quoted, this very tendency
is what destroyed our kingdom and ruined our holy temple and lengthened our exile. It connects this intellectual error to historical catastrophe.
That gives incredible weight to their argument against uncritically accepting texts like the Zohar.
It really does. Then there's a brief personal note from the author.
Right, about being born on Shavuot, named David and Shuvit, feeling connected to Moses and King David.
And praying for help to uphold truth in a generation where they feel truth is missing.
Which leads directly into prophecies about the end times, or the time of the Messiah.
Yes, citing the Talmud, Sanhedrin 97a, in the generation when the Son of David comes, truth will be absent.
And the face of the generation is like the face of a dog.
What does that mean?
Commentaries explain truth absent might mean persecuted or hidden, not totally gone. And face of a dog suggests outward loyalty hiding inner falsehood.
Deception, basically.
And another Talmudic passage. In that generation, brazenness increases. Things are expensive. The kingdom turns to heresy, and there's no rebuke. No one calls it out. And the author highlights that phrase.
Yeah.
The entire kingdom will turn to heresy.
Right, suggesting this state is almost a prerequisite for the Messiah's arrival.
And here's the author's interpretation, their diagnosis of today.
Yes. They state bluntly, the entire kingdom, meaning the Torah world, has turned to heresy.
Ow.
By inserting heresy and idolatry into the Torah disguised as truth. That's why truth is absent, they argue. That's why there's so much confusion.
They also interpret that line, the house of meeting will turn to prostitution.
As meaning idolatry, not literal prostitution, based on biblical language. So even synagogues or study halls are implicated.
And then the really direct accusation about current practice.
Yeah, this is a major claim. They say most, maybe even all, yeshivas and kollels study the contaminated Zohar, or at least commentators influenced by it.
So this widespread study is the heresy.
That's exactly what they claim. This is the heresy that has infiltrated the kingdom of Torah disguised as truth. This fulfills the prophecy, causes truth's absence.
And fulfills the no rebuke part too.
Yes, because they say rabbis and judges are afraid to speak out. Or they judge unjustly for various reasons, money, honor, envy, ignorance.
They give that specific example about tefillin on Shul HaMod, the intermediate festival days.
Right. They state the common ruling against wearing tefillin then is false, even heretical by their standard. They insist one is obligated.
And they claim to have proofs.
A whole pamphlet, apparently. They offer one. Rabbi Judah the Prince, Reshbi's own student, did wear tefillin on Shul HaMod, according to the Talmud.
And they make another point about Shabbat tefillin.
That while not obligatory, according to major authorities like Rambam, it's not technically forbidden.
So the argument is,
if Reshbi truly believed wearing tefillin on Shul HaMod was forbidden, or worse, heretical, cutting plantings, he would surely have told his star pupil, Rabbi Judah, who clearly didn't get the memo.
Therefore, Reshbi couldn't have held that view, and the Zohar attributing it to him must be wrong.
That's the logic. They also cite the Mishnah against misinterpreting Torah and the command not to add or subtract. They see the ban on Shul HaMod tefillin as an illegitimate addition.
And they mention other errors in the Zohar.
Briefly, yeah. Like claiming Abraham was the father of Tatrash, when the author says Nikor, Abraham's brother, was. A factual error to undermine its divine origin.
Then they loop back to the judges.
Quoting the Talmud, if a generation suffers, check the judges. Calamities come because of them.
And the prophet Micah's critique of corrupt leaders, priests, prophets who twist justice but still lean on God.
It paints a picture of widespread institutional corruption, in their view.
How do they suggest people should respond?
By quoting Deuteronomy about investigating thoroughly if there's suspected idolatry, inquire and investigate and ask thoroughly.
It's a command to seek truth actively.
Because if you don't, the abomination, the falsehood, gets in and takes root. And once it's there,
it's hard to dislodge. Like trying to convince someone 1 + 1 = 2, they've always been taught it's 3.
Exactly. Ingrained falsehood is powerful.
The conclusion brings in more quotes.
Yes. Reinforcing discernment. Jeremiah. They went after emptiness and became empty. Job. Silence is sometimes wisdom. Proverbs. The simple believes everything. The prudent watches their step.
And that maxim, accept the truth from whoever said it, attributed to Rambam.
And another saying, if you seek to hang yourself, hang on a large tree. Used, they note, by the rash bash against Kabbalists, advising distance from them.
And finally, that long quote from Rambam's guide for the perplexed introduction.
Right. Rambam saying the truly perplexed will benefit, but the superficially wise, whose minds are polluted with untrue ideas, will actually flee from the book.
Because it exposes the falsity of their cherished beliefs.
And Rambam's justification for writing such a controversial book, a time to act for the Lord, they have violated your Torah and doing it for heaven's sake.
He wrote it hoping to save even one excellent person, not caring about popular disapproval.
which clearly resonates with this author's mission. They also quote Rambam on Abraham being despised for standing alone for truth, prioritizing it over honor, a model for them.
And it ends with a blessing.
Yes, for the Jewish people, even those who err unknowingly.
Wow. Okay, that was a lot to unpack, a really intense perspective.
Definitely. We followed this argument that paints modern religious life as this stark battle where your very belief system is the front line against idolatry.
Right, using the Torah, Talmud, Rambam, to argue that believing in any power besides God, even passively,
is a fundamental rejection of faith. And then applying that razor-sharp critique to the Zohar.
Calling it late, wrong, error-filled, and the primary vehicle for introducing idolatry, fulfilling those dark prophecies.
Yeah, the claim that its study in yeshivas is the predicted heresy turning the kingdom away from truth is, well, it's a huge statement.
And hearing the author position themselves alongside figures like Moses, David, Rambam, Abraham, taking an unpopular stand for truth through investigation.
It gives you a sense of the conviction behind this.
This deep dive has really laid out one specific challenging viewpoint. It pushes you to think about what truth even means in religion, about tradition, authority.
And the potential dangers, from this author's perspective, of accepting certain widely held beliefs or revered texts.
So it leaves us, and you listening, with a pretty pointed question, really emerging from the core of this author's argument. If, as they argue so forcefully, believing in something they define as an other power or heresy invalidates your entire faith.
How do you navigate? How do you sift through all the texts, traditions, opinions out there to figure out what is that absolute non-negotiable truth and what, according to this very strict definition, falls into dangerous error?